savory day.
Sorry, that was a little too long of a musical intro. That is something I'm working on for the children's book, children's songs for, my church. We're doing a new songbook and new hymn book, and they're looking for submission. So, welcome to the third episode of Should Be Known. I'm Clayton Pixton, and today I have been kind of agonizing and doing more reading and prep for this than will be apparent, let's put it that way, because I don't have a really good outline of this podcast today. I just have a lot of thoughts, and we're not going to nearly be able to get to all of them. Just a quick review of last time, though. Well, we're not going to review it, but I just want to say one more thing. Last time we talked about how... let me just read the scripture that I pulled up. I introduced you to the very basic concept that when you discount moral truth and authority, you justify yourself in disobeying that truth and authority. Right? And I know that there are people, and you may be one, who don't believe in a kind of universal truth, or that there is the authority of God on earth. I understand that. But if there is, then it's not hard to see how that concept works. If that light is there and you go against it, you justify yourself in order to not feel subject to it. You might not believe that we do that, but I'm telling you we do. Let me just read. This is from the New Testament, John 3, verse 19. And this is the condemnation, that light has come into the world, and men loved darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. For everyone that doeth evil hateth the light, neither cometh to the light, lest his deeds should be reproved. So that's a simple concept, right? If there is a light of truth, and if you are doing evil, if you're going against that light, then you kind of want to avoid the light, right? Because the light is telling you one thing, and you're doing another. So you want to deny that light is what it is. I mean, that is a very basic concept that underlies everything. That's a summary of why we are here on this earth, to see what we'll do, whether we'll go to that light or go away from it. And if you read the scripture before that, it's clear that light is Jesus Christ. But we'll talk more about that, because it's like that light is in all things and through all things. But today we're going to talk about a guy in his book who he doesn't anywhere in the book say quite what I'm saying, that light is the light of Christ, which is what I'm going to say. And I'll talk about that, I guess, in another episode, and maybe the next one or something, if we can get through this. We'll see. So here's a book, and here's the guy that wrote it. It's called Bonds That Make Us Free: Healing Our Relationships, Coming to Ourselves. It's by C. Terry Warner, my old philosophy professor at BYU, a great man, and he is going to heaven. Okay, he's a good man. And he was right about many things, I believe. And some of his concepts are definitely worthwhile, and I wish that the psychology community or field or whatever would recognize that. I don't know if it ever will, because it's not secular. It's based on this notion that there is a light. In Terry Warner's mind, that light comes from other people. And he says that about 100 times in here. And I better give you a few quotes so you don't think I'm making that up. Page 21. From where does our sense of right and wrong come? In general, from other beings around us, other people and even animals, and, as I believe, God, though faith is an issue I will reserve for the epilogue. For example, in the expressions of others' faces, the tone of their voices, and their posture and gestures, we find indication of their emotional needs and feelings, and this gives us a sense of how we ought to treat them. There's nothing mysterious about any of this. Perceiving the cues or signals from others that guide us in how to treat them is basic to just about all we do in life. It is as commonplace almost as breathing. By saying there's nothing mysterious about this, I don't know. To me, that if you say it comes from God, there's something a little mysterious about that. Anyway, let me find the other place where he says, okay. Here it is, another place. We're constantly receiving signals from others that reveal something of their needs and hopes and fears. Martin Buber expressed this idea in these words: living means being addressed. We are called upon by others' unspoken requests, expressed in their faces and gestures and voices, to treat them with consideration and respect. And there are other places where he says that. Although, and then in the epilogue, he basically says, well, I believe it ultimately comes from God, but to me that's a little confusing, because you're here saying there's nothing mysterious about it and that it comes from other people. And then you all of a sudden kind of say it ultimately comes from God. Well, I better read that to you, or else you're not going to believe me. Okay. This is the epilogue. In this book, I suggested that this influence flows from beings who enter our lives and love us, blah, blah, blah. I believe that the ultimate source of that influence is God. And he explains how if he hadn't intervened, we'd all kind of fall into chaos without renewals of kindness from time to time. A loving, just influence must have been everywhere available to those who've chosen to attend to it. Call this divine influence the spirit of truth, if you will. Call it the loving justice that governs the relationships we talked about in this book. Whatever it be called, it seems to me a constant gift of that intelligent organisms cannot produce on their own. So that much, I believe, is true. It is abundantly available to each of us, whether or not we acknowledge its source. So, take what you will from that. He says kind of both things. We'll talk about that when we do the next episode. But anyway, that's one of the basic premises, that this influence is beating on us constantly. Well, in most of the book, it's not necessarily constant, in at least in his explanation, because it comes from our interactions with others. I'm going to say that it is constant, and it doesn't just come from others. It comes from God, and it pertains to things that are not just how we treat other people, but how we, you know, things that are not social necessarily in their nature, like going to vote, today's voting day, or paying a donation to, you know, nobody in particular, or, what else? Saying a prayer, eating healthy, keeping the law, you know. Okay, anyway, let's back up, and we're going to go right to the preface. I had a philosophy professor once who said that he can usually tell, like, in the first page if some philosophy book is going off track or not. Well, so I have, like, a love-hate relationship with this book and kind of Terry Warner's work. And I've been conflicted on how to present that because, like I said, he is a great man. I've benefited personally greatly from him. I just, I guess, disagree with a few of his points, and but I want to point them out and then be able to build on it without, I don't know, getting too hung up on what I think is insufficient or whatever. Let's read this preface. People can change fundamentally in their hearts and not just in their outward behavior. All right, well, I'm seeing some problems already there, but I feel like I should give you his basic, the things I don't disagree with, right? So, here's something I don't disagree with. A correct understanding of why we feel and think and act as we do helps to set us free. I agree with that. Let's find something else I agree with. We have all felt hurt or provoked or upset by the people around us, angry, for instance, or resentful or envious or intimidated or fearful or humiliated or disgusted by something done to us. We feel helpless to rid ourselves of these feelings. And this book is partly about how to get rid of those feelings. The unfairness, indifference, disrespect, rudeness, or cruelty troubles us through and through, sometimes only faintly, but always unmistakably. The pain, which is real, seeps into and taints every sector of life. Unclouded happiness seems impossible. Families who live on strained terms discover that their impatience and frustration contaminate every project they undertake, whatever the setting. Keep in mind that this condition is as common as breathing air. Let me give some examples. So we need to find language to talk about being stuck in negative emotions or attitudes. I will call them negative, accusing, afflicted, anguished, and troubled, aware that none of these words quite captures all I want to convey. So he's talking about feeling stuck in your condition and your yucky feelings. Then he talks about, change of heart. Let me touch on that later because it's a problematic concept the way he has it, I believe. Okay, so these feelings and this condition kind of has a grip on us. Okay, here we go, talking about self-betrayal. Often we have a sense that something is right or wrong for us to do. Sense, for example, that we should or shouldn't treat some person or other living thing in a certain way. Okay, that's the premise. Self-betrayal occurs when we go against the feelings I've just described, when we do to another what we know or what we sense, is what he said, we should not do, or don't do what we sense we should. He says, when we do to another what we sense we should not do or do or don't do what we sense we should. I would say when we do not to another necessarily, what we know we should not do, or don't do what we know we should. But anyway, he calls it self-betrayal when you do that. When you feel like you should do something and then you don't do it. And the minute you self-betray, you justify yourself. You enter this kind of living lie that paints the other person as, you know, bad, and you as justified, you as a victim of some kind. He says we needed to make the wrong we were doing seem right. Rationalization, self-justification, self-deception, blaming emotions and attitudes. So it's not just our thoughts, it's our feelings. So we really do get legitimately, you know, mad or whatever. He says we lie with our emotions and attitudes, and even with our moods, as well as with our words. And I would say, and thoughts. I'm sure he would say that too. Here are some examples: anger, self-pity, crustiness, suspicion, fear, impatience, bitterness, touchiness, arrogance, boredom, discouragement, despondency, humiliation, envy, hesitancy to take initiative, resentment, contempt, indifference, like about another person, like that person is not worth spending my time on. You'll notice that these emotions have some element of accusation. So all this I'd say is true, right? That we enter into this kind of mentality, which includes our emotions, that we, well, in this social setting, that's kind of limited way, I guess I'd say, we accuse the other person and excuse ourselves. They're self-excusing feelings. The feelings are real, but they're not truthful. We believe it's their mistreatment of us that leads us to accuse them. The truth is, we accuse them because of our mistreatment of them. Okay? So you get this, or you getting it? We don't have an awareness of going through this process. If we don't go through a process, how do we manage to deceive ourselves about what we're doing? The answer is the violation of our sense of what is right, the accusation of others, and the distortion of reality. All these are aspects of one and the same self-betraying act. They occur together rather than in sequence. And I'd say yes. Yeah, what is the thing we're going against? Well, to act as love dictates. That's the thing we go against when we're treating somebody bad. And more broadly, as we'll talk about in the future, it's just basically going against what you know to be truth through the light of Christ. Let's see. Only people who are doing something that goes against their own sense of right and wrong have to spend time and energy spinning out a self-justifying story. Have you ever noticed how you have lots of reasons, and people have lots of reasons for stuff when they're justifying themselves, whereas if they were just doing the right thing, they wouldn't have to say one thing. Well, this candy bar that I stole isn't, I mean, it's really not worth that much. And besides, you know, I got ripped off one time when I came to the store. And besides, all the stuff in here is overpriced anyway. And besides, the owner of the store doesn't need any more money. I mean, it's this huge corporation. Let's think about it. And besides, I'm really, really craving this candy bar right now. You can come up with multiple reasons. Anytime you're coming up with multiple reasons, be suspect, right? Okay, the very fact that we need to struggle for approval proves that we do not approve of ourselves. Having to convince ourselves of something means we do not really believe it. Yeah. All right. Two ways to be. To the immature, people are not real. That's something that Terry Warner read when he was, oh, how young was he? 10 years old. To the immature, other people are not real. And that was probably a formative, it definitely was a formative experience for him. He read that in a book and it kind of struck him. Okay, here's a description of if other people are real to us. To the extent that we act toward others as we feel we might, we open ourselves to their inner reality, and their needs and aspirations seem as important to us as our own. We hope their hopes will be fulfilled and need to see their needs satisfied. Their happiness makes us happy, and we are pained to see them hurt. We resonate with them and delight in their prosperity. Right? Imagine that. How many people do you experience that with? I'm not sure how realistic it is to feel that way about everybody every second, like even the Son of God. Was he thinking that about everybody he passed in the street? I don't know. But that definitely describes how God sees other people, how God sees all of us. And if you think about it for a second and examine whether you see other people that way, the same way that God would see them as a loving parent, it's pretty easy to see that we fall short a lot of the time, right? All right, so are you getting a taste of this book a little bit? That's just the first, eighth of the book. And then he goes into how, he describes it more, what it's like to be caught up in this and how we do it with other people. And he calls it collusion, when we kind of provoke each other to view each other in this bad way, kind of what he calls an I-it kind of way. And we kind of feed each other's self-justifications and self-deceptions about each other. And, you know, we've all done that when we've gotten to some kind of argument or fight or whatever. And some of us are in a pattern like that on an ongoing basis. And some people, have issues with family members or other people who have hurt them in the past that last a lifetime, sometimes beyond a lifetime, because people, die and they're still caught up in stuff. Okay, is this interesting to anybody? The book was interesting to me, and I've read his stuff. I'm very familiar with his stuff, and it was still fun to read. Partly because I made many notes, and I'm interested in the basic concepts. Not always his conclusions, but the basic insight. And that's how it is with all theories. It's like the insight is great. The insight is right. And once you start to build a theory and explain why we observe that, then you get into trouble and nobody can seem to figure it out. Once in a while, somebody gets a theory that really is useful. So what do we observe? What's the observation part and what's the theory part in this theory? Well, we observe that us and others get into this trouble and experience these we see ourselves living a lie. It's really hard to recognize when it's yourself, because it by nature blinds you to what you're actually doing, as well as blinding you to the nature of, somebody else or the world in general. Okay, here's the part of the theory that is just pure observation. And we'll separate it from the theory part of it, the building up a system of creating postulations that explain why we observe what we observe. Every theory has those two parts, and most people don't know how to tell them apart. Here's splitting those two parts for this agent of theory, as it's been called, or Terry Warner's kind of theory. So the pure observation part of it is that we see each other and see the world in ways that are erroneous. We see it in other people, and if we're honest with ourselves, we see it in ourselves. Just really weird stuff if you see somebody, you know, just feel this need to talk bad about this other person. You know that, you know, something's going on with them that they don't feel comfortable in how they're basically treating or considering this other person. They're living this lie, and in order to maintain their justification of themselves, they like have to convince everybody and talk about it and think about it in a certain way. You've seen that. If you're honest, you can see yourself doing the same thing. This would be a good place to give millions of examples, but not only do I not have them on the top of my head, but it would take a long time. But that's a good example. So we see that as an observation, and we look at that and say, well, why are we justifying ourselves? Why does it look like we're justifying ourselves when we don't even know it? And then we make the postulation, okay? Here's the postulation. We must be doing something that we know on some level is wrong, or that we feel is wrong. Why else would we be justifying ourselves? If we thought we were in the right, we wouldn't be doing any of this junk. We'd just be going about our business. We wouldn't be mad at other people and make a big deal out of this and that. We wouldn't be making ourselves into a victim. And we must be going against the truth, or at least going against something we think is the truth. And when, let's see, I wonder if the more you think about it, you have to conclude that it's a universal truth. I suppose somebody could say, no, it's just we feel we're going against something that we think is true, but it may not be true. But no, I think if you look at it, and if you're honest, and if you observe it enough, you'll see that there is a universal truth. It's as if there is a universal truth. Let's put it that way. It's as if there is a certain way to treat other people. And understand me right there. The way is to... It isn't to do a certain particular thing. The way isn't to do a certain particular action, but the thing to do is to, whatever you do, do it in a loving, considerate, respectful way. Speaking socially, speaking in the social aspect. And more broadly, there is a universal truth because it seems like, you know, you discover consistencies in how we justify ourselves, and it points to a universal kind of truth. I think that's fair to say, right? Okay, so those are the two parts. That's the postulation, that there's something like a truth that we must be going against, that we must know on some level. Who knows what level? But it's on some level, because we're spending all this energy justifying ourselves for things and deceiving ourselves. And you see people deceived in the same kind of ways. And then you look at other people and you see people deceived in really weird ways. But we'll get into that. But I think you can count on it that if somebody is deceived, even in a weird way, there's something they're going against. All right. That, the basic concept. It's been, 30 minutes or more, and I haven't really gotten to the second half of the book where Terry Warner talks about how to get out of this state of living a lie, because it's kind of a trap, or you can't see your way out of it. And it's a worthy question to ask. How do we get out of it? Basically, though, I can tell you what he says. I think I'm fair in saying that his basic strategy and advice is just to simply learn to recognize when and how you're being prodded to do the right thing and go along with it. Don't go against it. That's his basic. He says a couple exercises. You can write about someone who you are having a difficulty with and picture them as, you know, just how they are without judging them or whatever. That's a helpful exercise. He also says, what's his other exercise? Oh, describing a collusion you have with another person. And kind of spell it out, how I'm seeing them, how we're accusing each other. And those are the only two things I found in there that are actual action steps, action items that you can actually do to try to get out of this. Mainly, he says, kind of over and over, what you need to do is stop going against the light. Just stop. Just go with the flow, go with the light. Don't betray yourself. But to me, there's truth to that, but it leaves me feeling a little like, really? You don't have any other, you know, recommendation on how to get out of these really troubling life situations and debilitating self-deceptions and maladaptive behaviors and stuff like that. Just go along with the light. I mean, that's just too wispy to me. It's not wrong technically, but I think there's a lot more you could say. Let's say that. All right. So I hope you've enjoyed this introduction to Terry Warner, Bonds That Make Us Free. Concept of self-deception. I mean, well, self-betrayal, self-deception, self-justification. Specifically with him as it relates to other people and how we see them and how we treat them. Yeah, I hope you've understood somewhat. And yeah, enjoy it. What else can I say? I don't think everybody gets into it as much as me, but I'm seriously interested in the principles of psychology. Seriously interested. There are a few prayers I've repeated more than that I would be able to understand the principles of psychology. It's a lifelong goal of mine, maybe you'd say. And I think there are many valuable things in here. He does talk about the power of forgiving other people, or even asking them to forgive you for kind of accusing them in your heart. I do believe in the power of forgiveness. I believe it ultimately comes through Jesus Christ and his power to forgive. We wouldn't have power to forgive without him, I believe. Now, you cannot believe in Christ and forgive somebody. But whether you know it or not, whether you realize it or not, I believe you draw on that power. Okay, well, that's been a great episode, right? We'll talk next time a little bit more about maybe I'll rail on one more concept of his about change of heart, because it's part of the whole trouble about how to change. But he doesn't deserve railing on him. See, I'm conflicted with this. I hate saying anything negative about him or whatever, but I just there's part of it that just kind of makes me a little mad. Well, you're obviously self-betraying because, you know, blah blah blah. No, I really feel like there's some I don't let's say that this way. I don't like to leave the book the way it is. I feel like it could lead people in a direction that's just not right. But at the same time, I recommend it, I guess, and especially certain principles. And all right, I'm talking too much. You know that I how I feel about this. You can tell. All right. Well, I'm Clayton Pixon, and let's go with a little outro music. And we'll talk to you next time. Bye. Have a great day. Love you. Bye. Oh, I might not love you.